Today is February 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up.
Members of Congress, the state of our union is strong.
Also ahead, a new report by the United Nations claims North Korea is working to ensure its nuclear and ballistic missile capabilities cannot be destroyed by military strikes. And the UN Secretary General speaks to VOA about tensions in Venezuela. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump used the State of the Union address last night to make a final push for a wall along the southern U.S. border, just days ahead of what he has warned could be another government shutdown. Trump, who made a border wall one of his signature campaign promises, spent much of his speech on what he considers the dangers at the border with Mexico. Trump made his second State of the Union address with a new backdrop. For the first time, a Democratic Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi of California, looked over Trump's shoulder as he spoke in the House chamber of the U.S. Capitol. Democrats took control of the House of Representatives during November's midterm elections, and with Republicans leading the Senate, Trump faces a divided government that makes enacting his policy proposals much more difficult. In an apparent acknowledgement of that new political reality, Trump focused much of his speech on calls for unity and bipartisanship. For a look at national and international reaction to the president's speech, we have VOA national correspondent Jim Malone in the studio with us. Thank you so much, Jim, for joining us.
Sure, Kim.
Well, Jim, overall, how do you think the president did in his second State of the Union address?
Well, if you're looking at how he was able to connect to his core supporters and push for the policy initiatives that they favor, I'd say he did pretty well. And in fact, some of the instant polls right after the speech gave him a little bit of a boost. In the CBS News poll, a lot of people thought, they were favorable toward it. But I think what you'll find is that if he is looking toward his reelection and trying to appeal to a broader group, it was probably limited in scope. There wasn't a lot there for Democrats to grab onto, because despite the call for bipartisanship by the president, it was a few sentences later where he very eagerly told them, if you come after me with investigations, basically we're going to go to war. So he offered the alternative of, peace and legislation or war and investigation. Those are pretty stark terms.
Yes, they are. And also, just looking at that, so how do you think he will get any negotiations going with Democrats, given that?
The first test will be this border wall. We're coming up on a deadline next week. It was obviously very important in the address because he spent a lot of time on this issue. It remains a pivotal campaign promise. You have had Republicans in his own party tell him if he's not able to succeed on this, his presidency is over. That may be a little bit dramatic, but the stakes are clearly high. The problem is, I think, the president may be in a weaker political position, A, since the elections last year where Democrats took the House, and B, in recent weeks in the aftermath of the government shutdown, which showed that most people blamed him in the polls and that his approval rating has gone down. So it seems like the shutdown did not work for him. So what is the alternative now?
Yes, and also looking at some of the other highlights from last night, he acknowledged that more women are serving in the current Congress than ever before. So do you think this will... women in general will see him more favorably than they have in the past?
That's an open question. I'm sure he's hoping that's the case. I do think that for visual purposes, more than what we actually heard in the speech, the images of the Democratic women all dressed in white, presenting a unified front, what we saw was the new face of the resistance to President Trump on full display in the House chamber. This shows you that the political landscape in Washington has now shifted. And the question will be, for the president's own reelection hopes, does he adjust to this or keep going back to the same formula to try to get his bills passed and gain favor with his core supporters. And we saw in the shutdown that seemed to be a losing proposition. So where does the president go forward now? Can he find areas of cooperation, or is he going to continue to narrowly focus on pleasing his core supporters?
And also just real quick, looking on an international level, he did mention North Korea and that saying that had he not been president, we would be at war with North Korea. So what is the reaction to that?
Yeah, he's got a big stake coming up, the next summit, and it's going to be held in Vietnam. And of course, you know, had no mention of Africa in the speech. We right. often see that in the past.
Yes.
And I thought the Afghanistan aspect was interesting. He definitely seems like he wants to pull our troops out, provided what kind of peace agreement they can come to with the Taliban. But there's a very complicated process involved there.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. That's VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone here in the studio. Well, a new report by the UN claims North Korea is working to ensure its nuclear and ballistic missile capabilities cannot be destroyed by military strikes. VOA's Steve Miller has more from Seoul.
The announcement by UN monitors comes ahead of a meeting between U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea Stephen Biegun and his North Korean counterpart in preparation for a second denuclearization summit. The UN report found evidence of North Korea using civilian facilities, including airports, for ballistic missile assembly and testing with the goal of effectively preventing decapitation strikes. U.S. President Donald Trump has hailed tremendous progress in his dealings with North Korea and set the date for his second summit with Kim Jong-un for February 27th and 28th in Vietnam. Steve Miller, VOA News, Seoul.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, VOA's Margaret Bashir recently spoke to United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Bashir asked the UN chief about the political crisis in Venezuela and whether he thought new elections could be a solution.
I think it's for the Venezuelans to decide the solution. Elections is always one possibility. Our position at the present moment has been to say to the two parties, we are here, we are available to offer our good offices at your request. So we are not imposing ourselves at your request to find a political solution through the negotiations that are necessary for that solution to be possible. In any case, whatever the solution, it will have to be negotiated between the two parties because if not, of course, elections or any other solution will not go well. So I think it's important that the UN reaffirms its availability, the availability of its good offices to support any negotiation between the two parties for a solution to be found. The Venezuelan people needs it and deserves it.
VOA also asked Guterres about his concerns about military conflict inside the country or even foreign military actions in Venezuela.
I hope that that will not happen. I think that the times of foreign intervention in Latin America are long ago. I also hope that I was very encouraged by the demonstration last Saturday in which the demonstrations took place without violence. And our strong appeal is to avoid all forms of violence that, of course, serve no purpose and benefit nobody.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who spoke with VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. During the interview, he also spoke about his coming trip to Africa. You can watch the entire interview on voanews.com. Among the top stories in the world, high-level talks between the U.S. and China are set to resume next week in hopes of ending an escalating trade war between the two economic superpowers. Residents began cleaning up and assessing the damage to their homes in the northeastern Australian state of Queensland today after catastrophic flooding swept through the region. Hundreds of Pakistani and Kashmiri demonstrators rallied in Islamabad in support of Kashmiri rebels and to mark the annual day of solidarity with Kashmir. And a bushfire on New Zealand's South Island spread through thousands of hectares, destroying property and forcing the evacuation of about 100 homes today. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, a British photojournalist, John Kentley, who was seized by the Islamic State terror group more than 6 years ago, may still be alive. British Security Minister Ben Wallace told reporters yesterday that the British government believes Cantley is still alive but did not give other details. Security experts believed that Cantley was likely dead after his capture in 2016. He was seized with American Jim Foley in northern Syria. Foley's death was videoed by IS militants, an act that shocked people around the world. Cantley was last seen alive in a 2016 video taken in Mosul at the start of a siege of the city of Iraqi government forces. In July of 2017, media reports said that Cantley had died in an airstrike during the battle to recapture Mosul. But a French IS fighter told the French magazine Paris Match that Cantley survived the siege of Mosul and had been moved to Raqqa in Syria. VOA's International Edition continues. Well, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today meets with foreign ministers from nations fighting the Islamic State militants. The State Department today praised the 79 members of the coalition for their work against IS fighters. The department noted the work includes efforts to counter IS propaganda and recruiting efforts, block its financing, and stop foreign fighters traveling to join the militants. Later today, President Donald Trump will deliver remarks to the gathering. The president has said he has directed military commanders to begin planning to withdraw U.S. forces from Iraq and Syria. While the militants have lost almost all of the territory they once held in those countries, many defense experts in the U.S. and other countries have warned the fighters could regroup after American troops are gone. Well, the biggest waste facility ever built in a refugee settlement has begun operating in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, home to nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees. The UN Refugee Agency, which is funding the project, reports the treatment plant can process the body waste of 150,000 people every day. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
More than 750,000 Rohingya refugees have fled to Cox's Bazar since August 2017 to escape persecution and violence by Myanmar's military in northern Rakhine State. Thousands of other Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh during previous periods of repression in Myanmar. This huge population generates an enormous amount of human waste in the congested settlements where limited land is available suitable for latrine pits and wastewater treatment. UN refugee spokesman Andre Mahechich says managing the waste in this terrain requires an innovative approach. He calls the new waste treatment facility a major step toward resolving this problem.
The ability to treat large volumes of waste on site rather than having to transport it elsewhere is a critical step to safe and sustainable disposal of such waste in emergency situations. This will significantly reduce health risks for refugees and host communities alike and the likelihood of outbreak of diseases.
For example, he notes more than 200,000 cases of acute diarrhea were reported in the Rohingya camps last year. In addition, he says people are suffering from respiratory infections and skin diseases like scabies as a result of the unhygienic conditions. Mahechich tells VOA UNHCR plans to roll out similar treatment facilities at other sites to ultimately deal with all of the waste being produced on a daily basis.
The point of this is also that the end result is safe, that there'll be also biogas production as part of that. Whatever remains is made neutral in such a way that in no way can damage human health.
Mahechich says Bangladeshi authorities have provided the site for the waste facility. He says engineers from UNHCR and the British charity Oxfam, with support from Rohingya refugees, built the new site in just over 7 months. He says the initial cost of developing the site, installing the equipment, operating and maintaining the facility is just under $400,000. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. Medical researchers in Atlanta, Georgia, found that applying electrical stimulation to a part of the brain produced some surprise reactions in an epilepsy patient who was undergoing diagnostic testing. The doctors from Emory University School of Medicine said that they found that giving an electrical shock to the cingulum bundle area of the brain caused their patient to break into laughter, followed by what was described as a sense of calm and happiness. 2 days after the tests, the doctors decided to use their new discovery to help calm their patient during brain surgery that required her to remain awake for the duration. The doctors remarked that while the patient was initially showing signs of panic during the surgery, once the electrical stimulation was applied, she told jokes about her family and said that she felt relaxed and happy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Pope Francis has admitted that Catholic priests have abused nuns, in some cases keeping them as sex slaves. Speaking to reporters yesterday after a historic visit to the United Arab Emirates, the Pope said the church has worked to address the problem, but said it was still going on. The Pope said more needs to be done to protect women everywhere. VOA's Zlatis Hoke reports.
The Pope was asked about sexual abuse of nuns on his return flight from Abu Dhabi. He acknowledged that it has happened.
It's not something that everyone does, but there have been priests and even bishops who have done this. And I think it is still taking place because it is not as though the moment you become aware of something, it goes away.
The Vatican's women's magazine, Women Church World, reported a few days ago that in some cases, nuns were forced to have abortions, which is against the Church's teachings. Last November, the Catholic Church's global organization for nuns denounced the culture of silence and secrecy that prevented them from speaking out. The global Me Too movement was credited with encouraging nuns to speak out. The Pope admitted that some nuns have been used as sex slaves by the clergy. He commended his predecessor, Pope Benedict, for his effort to prevent the abuse.
We have suspended a few clerics and sent some away over this. And also, I don't know whether the process is over, but we have also dissolved a few female religious orders in connection with this, which is corruption, no?
Pope Francis said the mistreatment of women is a worldwide problem in some regions more than in others.
I dare say that humanity has not yet matured. Women are second-class citizens, and it starts from there, no? It is a cultural problem.
The pontiff praised a small girl who broke through security in Abu Dhabi to hand deliver a letter to him.
That girl has a future. Dare I say, her poor husband, eh? She was courageous. I liked it. It took courage to do that.
Pope Francis made a historic visit to the United Arab Emirates to promote peace in the Middle East. He said there is no religious justification for raising a hand in violence against a fellow human being. Zlatica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nigeria's presidential election is set for February 16th. President Muhammadu Buhari of the APC and top challenger Atiku Abubakar of the PDPs are both Fulani Muslims. A discussion on what's at stake on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Well, today marks the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. Coinciding with the day, the United Nations is calling for action to eliminate the procedure by 2030. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN estimates at least 200 million girls and women alive today have been subjected to female genital mutilation, a procedure that partially or totally removes female genital organs. The UN says every year, more than 3 million girls between infancy and age 15 are at risk of being subjected to the harmful practice. While FGM mainly occurs in 30 countries in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, it is a global problem, with some migrant communities carrying on the traditional practice in Western countries. The World Health Organization says FGM has no medical justification and leads to long-term physical, psychological, and social consequences. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says awareness of the harmful effects of FGM is growing, and progress is being made toward banning it in some communities. He tells VOA that given the rate of population growth in countries where FGM is prevalent, action must be accelerated to reduce the number of girls at risk of undergoing the procedure.
There was an analysis that was done by our colleagues in UNFPA estimating that if female genital mutilation continues to be practiced at current levels, 68 million more girls will be subjected to FGM by 2030.
World leaders overwhelmingly backed the elimination of female genital mutilation by 2030 as one of the UN's sustainable development goals. The UN considers it achievable if nations act now to translate that commitment into action. The UN says public pledges by entire communities to abandon female genital mutilation may be effective in some ways. The world body, however, says such pledges must be paired with comprehensive strategies for breaking down the cultural, traditional, and religious behaviors that allow the practice to persist. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, a special airlift for thousands of baby flamingos is underway in South Africa as drought puts their breeding ground in peril. VOA's Miriam Giallo reports.
A reservoir that hosts one of Southern Africa's largest flamingo populations is drying up. The site is littered with the bodies of hundreds of dead chicks. A rescue operation is being organized by environmental authorities along with local groups, including Project Flamingo's Linja Allen.
We need to put the effort into the strong ones. They are the most important ones, as we need to transport them as well.
The heat is causing the flamingo eggs to lose their moist protective cover. And with their inner membranes hardening, it's difficult for chicks to peck their way out. Many of the exhausted birds that emerge don't survive long.
Our day starts now at 4. We started with the feeding. It lasts out about an hour. In between, we need to monitor all the birds. We need to prepare the food. We need to make sure everything is clean. The birds are still safe.
Unfortunately, the future doesn't look bright, says Lesego Pule from South Africa's Department of Environmental Affairs and Nature Conservation.
Our biggest worry is that if we don't get the rainfall this week, the mothers who are sitting with their chicks may abandon the chicks and fly over somewhere. And if that happens, we'll have more than 3,000 chicks to deal with, and that could be a disaster.
Local diamond mines paid for an emergency flight to carry the first batch of 900 chicks to Pretoria, some 550 kilometers away. They landed in Mike Bolthuis's home. He turned his private residence into a temporary makeshift facility. He says returning the chicks to the wild presents several challenges.
The big problem and the second phase challenge is once they can eat themselves is to try and not have a further human imprintation on them. The human imprint is the biggest problem if you want to later reintegrate these birds into flamingo flocks or colonies.
Finding the just right spot will also be critical.
Once they are juveniles and they can eat themselves, you can put them at those dams, but there must be the correct mud and ground so they can make the nests.
The chicks in new homes are given baby cereal, sardines, eggs, prawns, and vitamin supplements. To simulate parents, feather dusters are placed in the chicks' boxes. Rescue organizers say chicks will likely spend 3 or 4 months rehabilitating at various sites before they are released back into the wild. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us. And thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.